Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello, and welcome to a special feature-length edition of the China Geopolitics podcast. My name is Chad Bray from the business desk here at the South China Morning Post. And just for something different, we thought we might put together a special episode analyzing China and its relationship with the United Nations. The month of July in 2021 is somewhat significant because it marks not only one, but two 50-year anniversaries for China and its relationship with the international community. On July 15, 1971, 17 members of the United Nations requested that a question of the, quote, restoration of the lawful rights of the People's Republic of China in the United Nations, end quote, be placed on the agenda of the 26th session of the UN General Assembly. 50 years seems like a good time to reflect on how China's relationship has changed with the UN over the decades, especially in the past 8 years under its president, Xi Jinping. Incidentally, it's also 50 years since a particular American diplomat, at the time the U.S. Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, made a secret visit to China.
And of course, I would say that that influenced the way people thought about the China representation issue at the United Nations. I mean, recognizing that the U.S. was beginning to shift its policy. And then, of course, the fact of the Kissinger visit made a huge difference when it came to thinking about Chinese representation and that vote in October 1971.
That's Professor Rosemary Foote. She's a senior research fellow at the University of Oxford's Department of Politics and International Relations and a research associate at the Oxford China Center. She's been publishing articles and books analyzing China's domestic politics and its international relations for roughly the last 40 years, but her latest book is most timely. It's titled China, the UN, and Human Protection: Beliefs, Power, Image. What are some of the things that you're reflecting on upon this anniversary?
Well, I've been reflecting on the changes over the decades in terms of China's relationship with the United Nations, changes and continuities, really. Clearly, when the PRC was established for 1949, it expected entry into the United Nations, expected to take over the seat from the Chinese nationalist government. And you could see a kind of a fairly positive relationship with the United Nations in those early years because of that expectation and the status that membership confers. But of course, then we go through a very long period of a highly politicized environment in which this question of representation comes to the fore. It's obviously knocked off course by the onset of the Cold War and the United States' relationship with China during the years when the Cold War is at its height. And the Korean War clearly influenced very prominently the ability of China to enter and take over the seat from the nationalist government now residing on Taiwan. So this becomes a very contentious issue. It becomes a contentious issue between the United States and its allies, because many thought the presence of the PRC government fully established in Beijing meant that its representation should be permitted within UN bodies. And that begins to become obvious that the United States' position on this steadily loses support as you move through the 50s and into the early 60s. Then you have a China, of course, that is takes a radical turn from particularly from the early 1960s, 63, and then through the Cultural Revolution, takes a very radical turn, and it actually adopts a very negative attitude towards the United Nations. It talks about needing to set up an alternative body and something that was more representative of the sort of what it called the emerging forces in world politics, more representative in particular of the developing world. So you have a period of strong antagonism. And then again, as the Cultural Revolution moves into a more conservative phase, a more controlled phase, as you move to the end of the 1960s, you get China's Beijing's consideration of its relationship with the United Nations and an understanding that its legitimacy requires it to be to have a relationship with that body, to be represented in that body. And so again, from the early 1970s, you have a desire to enter. So that's a very highly politicized environment for the first couple of years of the Cold War. And you get a debate in China about whether this is the United Nations of the United States, as it were, that it's a US-led organization, or is this a UN that actually can play an independent role in world politics? And I don't think that the Chinese really accept that the UN has a kind of an autonomous, independent role in world politics, really until the 1980s, actually. And so for the first decade of Chinese membership, it's really very distant. It often doesn't take part in voting. It is not a question of abstaining on votes. It's not participating in votings on the Security Council. So it's only in the 1980s, and partly as a result of developing country a discussion with Chinese diplomats, that you begin to see China take a more forward role within the organization. And of course, it mattered that Deng Xiaoping came to power and argued that China had to be internationally engaged. It needed to join international organizations. It needed to join non-governmental organizations and begin to play a larger role in world politics. And I would say that we have another turning point with the advent of the Xi Jinping administration. So the presidency of Xi Jinping has brought two or three things, I think, in terms of China's relationship with the United Nations. It's brought forth statements that you can find in past presidencies, but nevertheless are emphasized under Xi Jinping to the effect that the United Nations is the core multilateral organization in world politics, and the UN Charter is supposedly the framework for organizing interstate relations. So that's, you know, articulated very, very firmly. The second thing is that he's talked a lot about China needing to lead the reform of global governance, to play a role in setting rules, and using the UN as the venue, if you like, in order to demonstrate this more active, this more ambitious Chinese position. And then the third thing is actually to make the argument that China was the first signatory on the UN Charter, and therefore, it's always had an important role in the creation of post-war order. And it should continue to have that important role in shaping post-war order. So it's been an interesting, varied relationship, but always one in some senses that's indicated that the United Nations is an important legitimating body for China, for its beliefs, for the kinds of ideas that it wishes to articulate, for its relationships with a wider body of states.
And Professor, I wanted to talk a little bit about your book in this. You say in the introduction that Beijing is attempting to shape the United Nations from within. So I'm curious sort of what kind of examples you're seeing of that, and what sort of supports that move. Obviously, we've seen Xi say a number of things recently about the UN and where he wants it to head.
Yes, the book is focused in particular on the idea of human protection, as you can tell from the title of the book. But it's the idea behind that is that we've had a UN, particularly in the post-Cold War era, that has put the emphasis on the security of the individual as well as the security of the state. It's adopted a much broader definition of what represents threats to international peace and security. And therefore, what goes on inside states is seen as a security issue that should be on the Security Council agenda. Now, that's something that the Chinese and the Russians, but the Chinese in particular, in terms of my focus, they contest, because they argue that state sovereignty is the most important norm in international relations, providing order out of chaos, if you like, non-interference in internal affairs. So that means that when sort of human protection issues come to the fore, whether that's something like protection of civilians in armed conflict or the women, peace and security agenda or the idea of the responsibility to protect, the Chinese are very likely to either shape resolutions in order to emphasize their particular perspectives, or even to threaten use of the veto, or even actually use the veto. I mean, that's another interesting, regrettable in many ways, development in terms of China's UN behavior. It now is more willing to contemplate and actually to use the veto. So, for example, on the Syrian question, trying to keep Bashar al-Assad absolutely central to the resolutions, make sure there is not any attempt to overthrow him, no attempt at regime change, even questions about delivery of humanitarian aid, instead of coming via the Turkish border or whatever it might be, it all to be promoted through the central governing authorities. Something like the responsibility to protect, the idea that if there are mass atrocity crimes, then the international community has a duty to respond in various ways. That doesn't necessarily mean military intervention. That can mean negotiation, that can be good offices, negotiating strategies and so on. But the Chinese emphasis is very much on it's a state's responsibility to protect its citizens from mass atrocity crimes. If the international community has a role, then that role is determined by the state in question. It's not determined by outsiders. So there's this strong emphasis on nationally determined solutions, and the strong emphasis on the state as opposed to civil society. So in the book, I talk about the contestation between a UN that emphasizes a three-pillar structure, international peace and security, development, human rights, as being at the core of UN activity. And China, as an alternative, is putting forward what I describe as a triadic model that puts emphasis on the state, on the idea of social stability of societies and economic development. And if you have those three things in place, China argues that human protection is better guaranteed. So it's looking, if you like, in different ways, in different venues, to push that particular set of understandings, and also to try to frame documentation, resolutions, actual policy on the ground in accordance with those ideas. But it's a difficult thing to do. I mean, you know, the Security Council is made up of five permanent members, each with veto power. And so you have to reconcile, unless you want the organization to fail entirely. And clearly China doesn't want the organization to fail. So it's caught in quite a tricky place on a number of these issues.
Yeah, and I wanted to circle back with a little bit of that about sort of the state versus humanitarian issues. So, you know, for example, right now we are seeing increasing calls for the United Nations Human Rights Committee to send observers into Xinjiang. And, I'm curious how you see China managing, you know, that kind of situation where they've been quite vocal against other countries talking about what they say is an internal matter.
Yes. I mean, well, they've managed it in the Human Rights Committee, the Human Rights Council, they've managed it by generating a wide base of support behind their own position on what is going on in Xinjiang. So the Human Rights Council is made up of 47 member states, but you even if you're not actually on the committee, you can put your name to resolutions or to documents, statements, letters, whatever. So what has been happening in the Human Rights Council is a number of democratic states in particular around the world, and that's not just Western European or the Americans, it's a wider range of states, have been trying to put the Xinjiang issue in particular on the agenda, to have a resolution, to back various of the UN reports that have findings that there may well be mass atrocities taking place in there, may well be genocide and so on. The Chinese have countered that with statements often put forward by countries like Belarus, for example, which is saying really that actually, China's human rights protections have increased enormously over the years, that what is going on in Xinjiang is actually an anti-terrorism operation. It's not a human rights matter. And that China actually should be congratulated for bringing stability to that province, for bringing greater levels of development and the like. So there's a real duel going on within the Human Rights Council and beyond. But there's also one other thing that's important about all of this is that the High Commissioner for Human Rights has been asking to visit since about late 2018, I think. And the Chinese have imposed conditions on that visit. And she is unwilling, has been unwilling to accept those conditions. And so that is a weakness, I would argue anyway, in Chinese position, in that they wish to impose conditions. They're not assuming that she would go in there with an open mind. And I think Bachelet actually has a lot of credibility as a High Commissioner for Human Rights.
And can I interrupt you a second and ask if you could give our listeners a little bit of some of the conditions that China is trying to implement for such visits?
The conditions haven't been spelled out in detail, actually, but I imagine that they will be along the lines of, you know, visiting, that the visit is controlled, if you like, by the Chinese side, where you can go, who you can talk to, whether you can meet people on their own, you know, how far afield you can travel and the like. So I don't know the detail of the conditions, but I just know that there is a negotiation going on around those conditions. I mean, the other parts of the UN as well, the special rapporteurs, the special mechanisms, have also produced reports on Xinjiang and argued that, you know, this needs to be looked at. And again, China has tried to deal with that implied criticism by arguing that the special mechanisms, the special rapporteurs, are going beyond their legal mandates. They are not impartial on this matter and the like. So they've tried to sort of delegitimate that part of the human rights process with respect to Xinjiang. And it doesn't look like it's going to be resolved anytime soon.
Yeah, it's interesting that they're having those kinds of arguments about conditions when last year you had Xi Jinping share four proposals for the United Nations to, you know, play a better role internationally. And he talked about these four things. He said, stand firm for justice, uphold the rule of law, promote cooperation, and focus on real action. But does that, you know, sort of call conflict with China's own actions and you know, how is Beijing really trying to reshape the UN in Xi's vision or Xi's image?
In the case of Xinjiang in particular, they would argue very strongly, much as I've said earlier, that this is an internal matter And this is, I mean, if it is an international matter, it's to do with counterterrorism. And therefore, that's an important international norm which we are addressing and dealing with. But actually, this is an internal matter. So, as I've suggested, the vision of the United Nations is a very traditional one. It's a sort of a Westphalian interstate body as far as the Chinese are concerned, and that's what they would like to keep it as. So when they talk about rule of law or they talk about the UN Charter, their interpretation of the UN Charter is one that emphasizes very much the state-based notion of the organization, the state-based notion of the United Nations, and the idea that in a sense it is an interstate body that has a secretariat, but that secretariat is in many senses not an independent autonomous body, but one that offers advice, offers technical support, and interacts on in a sort of a reciprocal and mutual basis with the state members, but not beyond that. I think the main form of influence that I see is happening in the United Nations is to emphasize and centralize the role of development as in a conflict prevention role, in a stabilization role, in a role that really has proven important for China, they would argue, and successful for China, and can actually help to solve some of these problems of state fragility that we see around the world. So I would argue that Xi Jinping's message in particular is to emphasize how important economic development, poverty reduction can be to the resolution of a number of the issues that the United Nations has been grappling with over a number of years. The problem with that, of course, is it's a structural issue. It's a long-term issue. It doesn't help us deal with immediate crises, Myanmar, Yemen, wherever. It doesn't help us interact in a way that really necessarily is inclusive of wider societies. It's obviously a formulation that downplays the emphasis on human rights that you get within the UN Secretariat and within the UN Charter, I would argue, as well.
Yeah, and I want to talk another bit about, in your book, talking about China's development model. You say that, Beijing used the post-global financial crisis period to help spread its benefits of its development model. I'm curious, right now, and we're in this period of COVID, and how is China sort of using the pandemic to spread its development model? We've seen vaccines offered to various countries in Africa and other things. So I'm sort of curious how you're seeing that play out right now in this time period.
I mean, they have been arguing along the lines that, in a reactive sense, they've been arguing that the global financial crisis is a really good indication that the neoliberal economic model is unsuccessful and you need something different. And they point, obviously, to their own successes, increases in GDP per capita, poverty reduction. And, of course, this year was chosen as the year to argue that absolute poverty has been removed in China entirely. So that message is coming over very strongly. The COVID story fits into that by, arguing that China has been able to keep death rates extraordinarily low, and obviously the comparison with the United States is an important one for them to point up, that they have policies in place that show the power of what they would describe as a meritocratic state to actually work efficiently to keep numbers low, to actually prevent widespread close downs of the economy, the domestic economy, to get on top of these situations very, very quickly. So it points up, the efficiency and the it's a more caring society in many ways, because it's arguing that it's actually, you know, saving large numbers of people's lives, and of course arguing that it is willing to pass on vaccines to the developing world, whereas other parts of the world, the Western states in particular, have pledged but not necessarily delivered in large numbers and so on. So obviously it's an environment in which it can push the model of the socialist state that focuses very much on both protection of its own citizens and development issues as a way of bringing about outcomes that are far better for large numbers of people, and far better, of course, for people in poorer societies.
Yeah, and along those lines, we've seen China making a lot of loans and as part of its Belt and Road Initiative over the last few years. So how important has that the Belt and Road been in transforming China's relationships with the United Nations, whether it be with other member states or with the body itself?
The Belt and Road is obviously represented within the United Nations. I mean, if I could take a step back and talk about Xi Jinping's pledges to the United Nations in 2015, I mean, there were both pledges in terms of troops, peacekeeping troops, standby forces, but also financial pledges. And one was the setting up of the Peace and Development Trust Fund, a 10-year fund, two sections of it. One was devoted to the sustainable development goals, and the other is for spending in the office of the Secretary General. Chinese are strongly represented in the committees that oversees how the funds are used. In the sustainable development goals section of the funding, the Belt and Road Initiative has been aligned with the sustainable development goals. So there is obvious reference to Belt and Road funding when we're talking about sustainable development goal policies. There's serious UN representation at Belt and Road conferences. The Secretary General obviously has been to the two major conferences that have been held on the Belt and Road. And so again, that has served, if you like, to legitimate the Belt and Road. So instead of thinking of it solely as China's bilateral relations with individual states on its borders and beyond, because the Belt and Road, after all, reaches vast distances, it can say, actually, this is also a global public good. This is a multilateral framework as well. And look, lo and behold, the United Nations is associated with it, whether that's the UNDP or the Sustainable Development Goals. And there have been moves by China to try to introduce the phrase Belt and Road, or to talk about Chinese development initiatives associated with infrastructure. Is that there have been moves to make direct reference to those developments in UN Security Council resolutions, but there's something of a pushback by other Security Council members on that front. So yes, the UN is important to Belt and Road because it helps to kind of globalize it as a phenomenon, to legitimize it as a phenomenon.
Yeah, and during that period, that time frame, we also have seen, in addition to China actually committing troops to peacekeeping operations, but they become the second biggest financial contributor to the UN behind the United States. So how closely is that funding tied to China's ultimate strategic goals?
Well, the funding it is determined in part by the size of your economy. So there are certain obligations that come with economic size. But things like obviously the troop contribution, which is, as you know, because the Chinese make the point many, many occasions, they have more peacekeeping troops than all other permanent members combined and so on. So they had about 2,500 troops in the field in the 12 or 13 peace operations that are going on at present. This is important to the idea that China is a respectable global player. It's a responsible great power that, as a P5 member, has responsibilities and it's fulfilling these responsibilities. It's the second largest contributor, as you say, to the budget. It's the second largest contributor to the peacekeeping budget and so on. And obviously, whether or not you choose to exercise that power directly or indirectly, it's always there. The notion that funding is incredibly important. As you know, the UN is always strapped for cash, but it's been particularly strapped for cash in the last few years. And so that gives them, obviously, it gives them position, it gives them influence in negotiation, it gives them on the budgetary committee and the like. You know, they're going to be listened to because of the position that they are in and because of the other commitments that they have made to the United Nations.
Yeah, and having been in New York for many years before I was in Hong Kong, I'm well aware of the status of the UN building and often the complaints people have about its upkeep. Let me circle back to a quote that you have in the book, quoting Xi Jinping in 2009 while visiting Mexico. He said, quote, "First, China does not export revolution. Second, it does not export famine and poverty. And third, it does not mess around with you. So what else is there to say?" Now, 12 years after that, you know, what else might you suggest there is to talk about China's external relationships, whether it be within the South China Sea or with the United States?
Well, obviously, there is a huge amount to say. Even in that statement in 2009, it was almost as though, you know, this is China. It's a passive actor. It's a creator of order simply by doing nothing. You know, in other words, it doesn't kind of disorder the world. It just gets on with its own thing, and that's its major contribution. And clearly, it's always had much greater impact than that statement implies, either directly or indirectly. Simply, you know, just things like, you know, the largest consumer spender in the luxury goods market or the highest emissions of CO2, you know. So it is out there in the world in that kind of sometimes unintended way and makes a huge difference to the kind of world we live in. Now it's much more active and ambitious in terms of putting forward its own foreign policy interests. So instead of, if you like, just standing back rather passively, not disordering the world, if you like, it's now attempting to order the world. And that means that it has higher expectations about the deference of others to its interests. It's more willing to struggle for its interests. And it's more willing, if you like, to argue that it has a rightful place in the world that others just have to accept and be able to deal with. So, I mean, we have to get used to all of this. A lot of this is perfectly understandable and legitimate. But at the same time, what China fails to do, I think, is to look at the world through the eyes of others. It finds it extraordinarily difficult to think about what it means for its neighbours, that it has emerged as a major military, economic, political power in global politics with a range of interests that it wishes to see satisfied. You know, it sort of thinks of itself in some ways as put upon by others rather than this macroeconomic actor of huge importance. And I think that sort of unwillingness, if you like, to compromise on some of its core interests means that it's always going to find it difficult to lead by consent. I mean, I think the big problem about China's increased power in many ways is that followership, it depends rather more on the coercive elements within its policy than the idea of a kind of a legitimate consent to some of the goals. And this is particularly true in the South China Sea. I mean, the unwillingness to accept that other countries have reasonable claims, the unwillingness to think about that as a shared space, as it has been historically, and the like. That's an extraordinarily difficult thing for them to overcome, except that they seem to be wanting to overcome it basically by imposition rather than by agreement. And that's very unfortunate, I think, and I would argue is a huge weakness in Chinese policy. The other weakness I see is actually an unwillingness to allow Chinese that are not on the mainland to live in different ways. Why do we all have to live in the same kind of system, whether you're on Taiwan or in Hong Kong or wherever? Do you have to live in exactly the same way to be Chinese? And in my view, that's a weakness in Chinese positioning, the inability, if you like, to think about the variegated ways in which we might all choose to live in world politics.
Yeah, and another thing I wanted to talk about, following up on neighbors and sort of relationships with neighbors, you've written about Russia and the U.S. and how they exist at sort of either end of the spectrum in the relationship with China. Putin and Xi seem to have a very good relationship. I believe they've you mentioned in the book about them both inviting each other first for various visits, but then the U.S. has increasingly had this more suspicious relationship. But within all of that, you sing out Japan as being the most successful of managing its relationship with China. Quote, you say, Japan has been perhaps the most successful in selectively engaging with Xi's worldview where it benefits Japan. So I was wondering if you could unpack that a little bit for us and explain how Japan is selectively engaging. I know we've talked in the podcast recently about Japan seeking some more help from Europe. In terms of having a military presence to help offset somewhat what's happening with China in the region.
Yes. I mean, it's a very difficult balance to strike for the Japanese, obviously. But of course, they won't always get it right, and they haven't always got it right. But they have managed to sustain a close interdependent economic relationship with China so far through very difficult political times. And you have to remember this is it's twofold difficulty, isn't it? On the one hand, Japan is America's most important ally in the Asia-Pacific region. And of course, Japan is also the alternative other, the difficult relationship of the war years and so on with China. So very, very difficult relationship to get right, but they seem to have been able to do it by, if you like, moderation in language, a continuation of the economic contacts and the economic relationship, but also, if you like, drawing on the power of others to fulfill roles. So, you know, much more sort of indirect. I mean, you may think of it as inappropriate way of going about it, but it's a way in which they've dealt with the fact that they are always going to live in a region in which China is a dominant player, a major player, their neighbor. But at the same time, they wish to retain as much agency as possible, as much autonomy, policy autonomy as they possibly can. So actually trying to think of ways, using language very carefully, Belt and Road is quite an interesting example of where the Japanese have not sort of been outright dismissive of it. They haven't signed up, they haven't got their memorandum of understanding with China, but nevertheless, they have signed up for some joint infrastructure projects and so on. You know, the possibility of the two countries working together on those kinds of projects in Africa or elsewhere is not impossible to conceive and so on. So actually sort of trying to find ways of moderating the high levels of tension that of course exist in that particular bilateral relationship, and not always getting it right, but never sort of pushing it to the point of an outright break. And that's obviously in part because Japan has its own levers that it can pull, particularly on the economic side and so on. So it's it is a really very, very difficult one, and it does draw on the influence and power of others in order to fulfill some of the objectives that it might have.
And Professor, I wanted to ask, is there anything else that I should raise with you that perhaps you think our listeners would like to hear more about?
Wasn't expecting that one.
That's the curveball my producer throws. So,
I suppose if you were to ask me, where has China made most progress in the UN setting in terms of its own aims and objectives, I would say in the human rights area. And I would say this is partly because it's emphasized development as a foundational right and has been able to, for the first time actually, to pass resolutions at the Human Rights Council that embody a number of its central ideas about development as a crucial human right. So I would say that, you know, they're shaping that discourse and shaping the institution of the Human Rights Council in a way that's not possible with the Security Council, partly because of the design, the difference in design between the Council, the Human Rights Council, and the Security Council, but also because there are opportunities within that Human Rights Council to elaborate your particular perspectives on rights, you know, to hold special exhibitions, to use statements, to use resolutions, to use other mechanisms, if you like, to set out your stall on human rights. And they've done that. I mean, so there is a criticism that's coming from them on the idea of universality of rights. There's a criticism of the idea of indivisibility of rights. There's an emphasis on development as the primary right and so on. And there is a obviously constant reference to their own 40 years of development as something to, not necessarily to be fully emulated, but nevertheless as providing some kind of vision for others. So I'd say that the biggest challenge in terms of China and global order is to the way in which we think about human rights.
Professor Foote, thank you so much for your time.
A big thanks to Professor Rosemary Foote. Her new book is China, the UN, and Human Protection, Beliefs, Power, Image. Stay up to date with everything happening with China and the international community on scmp.com. You can follow us on Twitter at SCMP Economy. And my name is Chad Bray. I'm at Chad Bray on Twitter. Thanks for joining us. Have a good week, and we'll see you later in the week on Friday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.